It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later this hour, the new novel Black Sunday revolves around a family living in Lagos, Nigeria. It's told in the voices of the four children of the family as they grow and deal with family trauma and poverty. I'll talk with debut novelist Tola Rotimi Abraham. But first, Jerry Schnorr has been studying and educating people about climate change for 30 years. Now, many people around the world are experiencing the catastrophic effects of climate change firsthand, including right here in Iowa. Schnorr is a professor of civil and environmental engineering and co-director of the Center for Global and Regional Environmental Research at the University of Iowa. He'll be speaking about climate change and Iowa on Thursday, February 6th at Blank Park Zoo in Des Moines as part of the Hope for the Wild Conservation Speaker Series. And he is here with me now. Hello, Jerry.
Hi, Charity. Thanks for letting me be on.
Well, thank you for being here. And you have been not just studying climate change, but really giving similar presentations about climate change for the last 30 years. And I think that's probably surprising to some people to know that you've been doing this research. And have things changed that dramatically in the last 30 years?
It has changed a lot. And for 30 years, actually, our center, the Center for Global and Regional Environmental Research here at the University of Iowa, began in 1990. So it's been 30 years. And 30 years, sometimes I feel like Groundhog Day, in that I'm repeating the same speech over and over every single day for 30 years, and it doesn't stop. The message hasn't changed, but the effects have gotten much worse during that time.
It's interesting to think about your perspective as an educator, because I remember when I was growing up learning about climate change, and at that point, it wasn't a controversial issue. So you've seen controversy about climate change ebb and flow over these three decades. Give me a little bit of perspective on what you've seen.
Well, it's true. If you think about through that 30-year period, there were different times when 1997, for example, with Al Gore, and when his book and his film came out, when it seemed like we were going to get some bipartisan major climate change legislation in our country. And for various reasons, it fizzled out. It never really happened. Another example, in 2007, about 10 years later, Congress passed the Energy Independence and Security Act, EISA. And in that act, that's the one that gives us the renewable fuel standard, which you've talked about on Talk of Iowa. And this bill that was passed at that time, Energy Independence and Security Act, was really the only one that included some climate change verbiage and a goal to reduce greenhouse gases in making liquid transportation fuels, of course, from corn and soybeans and even from switchgrass and things like that. So back then, they wrote that into the bill thinking that it's going to be a national goal to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions, to lower our fossil fuel use in 2007. Then the recession came and various factors. Again, it just fizzled out. John McCain sponsored climate change bills. There has been bipartisan support at different times, but at the moment, not.
After that bipartisan support, then we really saw the rise of the climate deniers, people who claimed that this is not happening. What did that feel like from your perspective?
Well, that was a blow, because prior to that, again, I always assumed, just imagine a country of the wealth and prosperity and size and consumption patterns of the United States of America with no clear energy plan whatsoever.
I don't think we have to imagine that, Jerry. We're living that.
Exactly. And no, the other side of that coin is no clear climate change legislation either. And so it's due time, but when the sides have become entrenched now, it's not really a science issue anymore. Why should climate change be a partisan issue? It's really all about science. And the science is very clear. The evidence is massive, Charity. From space, from land-based sensors, from some of the best evidence from oceans now that the oceans are heating up, the fossil record, the tree ring record, our ice core record. It just comes in from all over, many, many multiple lines of evidence all pointing to the same direction, that it is indeed getting warmer. We've changed the energy balance, and it's due to humans. It's due to our emissions of fossil fuels. Just imagine when you burn coal that's been in the ground for 340 million years since the Carboniferous age, and you burn it up in just a blink of time in geologic time in, say, 200 years, of course you're going to change the composition of the atmosphere. You've taken all that carbon that was stored and you removed it and put it into the atmosphere. Well, it wouldn't matter so much because carbon dioxide is just a trace gas, about 413 parts per million in the atmosphere, but it's a radiatively important trace gas. That means it changes our energy budget. It's like putting a blanket over the atmosphere of the Earth and warming the Earth. And that's what's happening to us.
Let's talk about some of the catastrophic things that we are seeing right now as a result of climate change. And I want to start with wildfires, because, of course, we've seen terrible, terrible wildfires in California, just horrific wildfires in Australia. And I think for some people, it's hard to connect the dots between climate change and wildfires, because fire doesn't necessarily... it's not connected necessarily to the climate. So connect those dots for me.
Basically, around the world, what has happened in those 30 years that we're talking about is dry areas have gotten drier in general, and wet areas have gotten wetter. There's good meteorological and climatological reasons for that. Maybe we won't go into the details, but California and Australia are some of those arid areas that are getting more arid, and that means longer periods of drought. It means the fire season starts earlier, ends later, and becomes very destructive, because in the meantime, we've built our homes into the forests, both in California and in Australia. And of course, the Amazon was burning this year, and Indonesia and Asia also was on fire. And that's just going to be the new norm, I'm afraid. As the ground gets drier, the air is warmer, so what little soil moisture there is evaporates faster. And that causes the fuel on the floor of the forest to become quite fire-prone.
We also are, of course, interacting with these fires in new ways because of the way we live. And because of the way we live, we've changed the environment, which is making the fires more serious, right?
Yes, that's correct. In California, in Australia, in the Amazon, climate change is visited most noticeably by this increase in the fire season and intensity of the fires. In Iowa, it has to do with more intense precipitation.
Right. You said the drier places are drier and the wetter places are wetter. That's where we fall, right?
Exactly. We're a wetter place. And most of our, a good deal of our precipitation comes from the Gulf of Mexico. And the Gulf of Mexico is quite a bit warmer than it used to be. We know that. We have sensors, very good record since 2005, and satellite record even before that, going back to 1979. We know that it's warmer, about a degree warmer on the surface, and that's what fuels these intense storms. It's also what causes more moisture to come up to Iowa and causes our storm events to be more intense and more frequent, both. I looked in the record with my students going back 100 years, and you're hard-pressed to find in Iowa a 4-inch rainfall on a single day. Now, it's really not that uncommon, and that means flooding. When you have that type of intense precipitation, it means flooding.
Now, I know that most of the people in our audience have heard this explanation before, but I do want to revisit. Please help us understand the difference between climate and weather, because there are some people who, when you say, you know, the planet is warming, Iowa is warmer, people will say, well, what about that polar vortex last year? That was really, really cold.
That was really cold, and I've been asked about that a lot. In fact, it did cause our temperature to be maybe slightly cooler, averaged over the whole year here in the Midwest compared to, say, the East Coast or the West Coast. But even that might be a symptom of climate change because the jet stream is getting weaker. It's wobbly now. And that's because the Arctic is.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about climate change and Iowa. With me, Jerry Schnorr, who's been studying climate change for 30 years. He's a professor of civil and environmental engineering and co-director of the Center for Global and Regional Environmental Research at the University of Iowa. He'll be speaking about climate change in Iowa on Thursday, February 6th at Blank Park Zoo as part of the Hope for the Wild Conservation Speaker Series. And Jerry, just before the break, we were talking about these really horrible storms that we are seeing in the Caribbean and hitting, of course, the United States and other places as well, and the storm surges these are causing. I want to touch on Bangladesh briefly, because this is a place in the world where people have lost their homes already because of climate change. We see climate change refugees. They can't live there anymore. Tell me a little bit more about what's going on there.
I was fortunate to be able to represent the media in the Paris Climate Agreement. And I got to meet people from these poor and vulnerable countries like Bangladesh, the Maldives Islands, which are already having to move people, not necessarily due to the sea level, although that plays a role, but again due to the storm surge. And yes, we have climate refugees already. I've met some of them and talked to them. And it could end up being millions of climate refugees. Some people even say that the unrest in Syria began with drought and climate refugees and pushback on the government. I think that is controversial, but one does wonder all the triggers that are involved with droughts and floods coming more frequently and more intensely.
Let's talk about Iowa, because when we talk about these far-flung places, climate change can seem far away. But let's talk about the changes here in Iowa that some of us are living with every day that have become kind of the new normal around here.
Well, lest we forget, 2019 was a remarkable year in Iowa, a devastating year from the standpoint of climate change. Both two rivers surround us, and both of them, river to river, flooded. Hamburg, Iowa, was underwater for 6 months and only recovered after $1 billion of investment since 2011. Now we're there again. Right. It happened with a bomb cyclone pouring rain on top of a record snowfall. And the Missouri River flooded. Likewise, on the other side of the state, Davenport and Burlington were with HESCO barriers, temporary flood walls. They don't want to cut themselves off from the river. With temporary flood walls, finally, after 50 days in a record flood stage, the barriers broke and flooded downtown Davenport and Burlington at great expense. Can you imagine, Charity, that in 2019, if you look from September 2018 to August 2019, that's a year period, averaged over the whole state of Iowa, we had 50 inches of precipitation. Our average is 34 inches of precipitation. We are not just breaking records. I'm here to tell our listeners, we are shattering records. Climate has really changed here already, and it's going to get worse before it gets better.
Well, and thinking back, I mean, we were all so stunned by the floods back in 1993, but that cycle has sped up. We've seen these catastrophic floods so often since then. And I think in a drought year like 2012, it's hard for us to remember the flooded years.
That's
but
right.
We are experiencing these extremes. So, okay, we see climate change. We feel climate change, even if we don't know that it's climate change. But let's talk about adapting to climate change, because, of course, humans are adapting to climate change. Wild creatures are either going extinct or adapting to climate change. What does this look like?
Of necessity, we are adapting to climate change, and cities and towns and states are responding because they have to. They're raising highways like we did here in Iowa City. They're raising bridges and making them stronger. They're changing their electrical substations to be on the roof instead of at a low place. And many, many adaptations we're making. If you have to build in the floodplain, which you should not do because it's changing, but if you must, it's got to be a floodable building where you can just hose it down, no porous materials, just hose it down after the flood and start over again. So, yes, we are adapting, but the other part of the story is mitigation, and that is we have to be a part of stopping this problem. We have to transition from the fossil fuel age, move to renewables and energy efficiency, maybe even nuclear power in the out decades. But for now, that's not going to help us because it takes too long to place a plant. And so really what we're talking about is it is a climate emergency, because by 2030, according to the United Nations, the best models, we're running more than 20 different climate models at a time and comparing them. By 2030, we need a 45% decrease in carbon emissions from burning of fossil fuels. That's a major challenge for our kids, but also it's a major opportunity because it's going to provide the opportunity for jobs in the solar industry and in the wind industry, already employing hundreds of thousands of people more than the coal miners, about 75,000. So it's a growing industry that's creating jobs, wealth, and prosperity, but it's not happening fast enough.
Well, there's political resistance to it happening because we're still seeing the subsidies for the fossil fuel companies. Political will may or may not change in the next 10 years or so. We will see. But what do you see that's possible in the private sector without that political will?
Well, that's a great question. And really, the action is not at the national or even international Paris Climate Agreement area right now. It's with cities and NGOs and businesses and commerce, all acting on their own, and individuals who want to reduce their carbon footprint as well. It's incumbent on all of us because it really is an emergency, and we have to reduce our emissions. We are, but we also need kind of a economic climate signal that fossil fuels are bad and become expensive, and that will, by economy of scale, cause renewables and energy efficiency to become cheaper and cheaper, thus creating the jobs and the opportunities for the future. In Iowa, we need to use our biomass. We need to co-burn and have biorefineries from our biomass. We need to put carbon back into our soils. We need to replant our forests, which have been cut down. And that is true for all over the world. Massive forest plantations are going to be needed and will help also the Hope for the Wild, the Blank Park series, because we're losing so many species. We need habitat as well. We're going to weatherize our homes. It's going to create thousands of jobs. We're going to have a smart grid for transmission of our electricity. We're going to electrify everything. That means electric vehicles, but they can't be recharged with coal-fired power. They have to be recharged with renewable energy. Battery technology, actually here at Iowa, we're one of the leaders in battery technology. And regenerative agriculture, we need to find some new perennial crops as well as use the ones we have now, like switchgrass, to put carbon back in the soil. We call it carbon farming.
I recently heard former Secretary of Agriculture, former Governor Tom Vilsack, speaking about agriculture, and his goal with dairy farming is to push dairy farming toward becoming carbon neutral. And he was saying that he believes that the technology and the knowledge is there to make it happen. But again, it comes down to political will, and it comes down to making it, a lot of people like to demonize our farmers, but when there's no economic incentive to be greener in your practices, and when there's actually an economic hit for many of these farmers in being greener in their practices, that's a really tough decision to make. So I understand that the science is there. What needs to happen?
Well, I'm an Iowa boy, so I'm completely grew up in Davenport, Iowa. My mom's from Muscatine, and I'm completely sympathetic to the farmer. They're dealing with the tightest margins of perhaps any industry there is, and the vagaries.
And they're dealing with flooding and droughts as well.
Exactly. We can incentivize, and we know how to do it. It has to be more than we have allowed so far. And that has to come from, as you said, the political will of the people to invest in a different kind of agriculture that becomes close to net zero carbon or carbon neutral. And as particularly the dairy farms in Iowa are very innovative. Many of them are already collecting manure, digesting it, using microturbines to make all the electricity for their own operation, and putting it into the grid. So we have some innovators. We just need more incentive for them to prosper.
It's I know you're not a politician, but I want to return to this idea. This has become such a political football, but to listen to you talk about it, I mean, this is in everyone's best interest, no matter what your political affiliation is. How do you think we get past that?
I think that I tell my students, actually, your number one obligation is to vote. If you believe, and we had an example of that with the caucuses last night in Iowa, even though we sort of botched it.
But nevertheless, more on that later today.
But nevertheless, you need to vote. You need to vote for people who realize, and it's not a belief system, it's science. It's a fact that when you release greenhouse gases to the atmosphere, it's going to change the energy balance. We've known it since 1859, John Tyndall's famous experiment. So it's a fact of what we're doing. It's not a belief. And so we have to have politicians who recognize the science. All over the world, most leaders do call dearly on their scientists to advise them. We don't have that right now in our country, I'm sorry to say. And that's the first duty, is to vote for people who realize this is a systemic, serious problem that really, I worry about my granddaughters. I have twin 7-year-old granddaughters here in Coralville. I worry about them very much as to what kind of world we're going to leave for them. And Greta Thunberg is right to be angry, because we are handing our granddaughters and grandsons a messed up planet lest we do these things that we're talking about.
For individuals, it can feel a little bit like spitting into the ocean to make some of these personal changes that reduce a person's carbon footprint. So beyond political action, what do you think people can do that can make a difference?
Well, you can reduce your own carbon footprint and go to bed feeling well about yourself in the evening. That's incumbent for us to do that as well. But we need changes in the political system. We need to send a price signal into the marketplace, because while many good things are happening, solar and wind, jobs and industry, even here in Iowa, it's not happening fast enough for that 45% reduction by 2030, and we need government to help us with that, and that means voting.
So we've talked about innovations, and of course humans are an endlessly inventive and resourceful species. So it seems like there are so many things that we can do. If we've invented all of the things that have gotten us to where we are, we can invent many other things, right? But let's talk about modifying people's behavior, because getting people to embrace lifestyle changes is extremely difficult, because we don't necessarily feel like it's in our own best interest. If we're making sacrifices and we see other people not making those sacrifices, where do you see innovation in that field, in changing our behavior?
I would start with the young people, because they're more inclined to, with Greta Thunberg and who was here in Iowa City, and the message is that they get it, and they're going to have to spread it to the rest of us. It's okay for them to have school strikes. It's good because it helps to spread it and make other people realize that we're doing intergenerational equity is an important aspect of justice. That is that we shouldn't foreclose the opportunities of future generations based on what we want to do now. And that's how it's going to spread, I think, from the young people throughout the population, because they are like the vulnerable countries. They've done the least to cause the problem, and they're the most affected. So that's how I would propose that it happens.
As we started this conversation, you were talking about the fact that you've given basically the same presentation over and over and over again for the last 30 years. Do you feel hopeful about our future?
We still have time, but it's running out. So one reason I get up every morning and give the same talk again on Groundhog Day is because we can still do this and prosper while doing it. We really can. And but we can't let it go much more because, it as I mentioned at the outset of the show, it's going to get worse before it gets better. We've already loaded the system for more warming, and there's a 100-year time lag in the gases that we put up now will continue to warm for 100 years. So it is an emergency. We need to start now in order to stabilize our atmosphere and thus stabilize our climate.
So you know that change is possible, and that keeps you motivated. Do you see change happening that keeps you motivated? Are there things that make you feel like we're making progress?
Oh, there are lots of good things. Solar and wind are growing worldwide about 14% per year. Coal is actually declining. Oil and gas are still going up ever so slightly. We have to level those off and then have a decline of, 45% by 2030. But in the meanwhile, while solar and wind are growing the industries at 14% per year, it doesn't take long for that to become dominant. That has to continue for the next decade and out and beyond.
Is there, we only have about 30 seconds left, is there a technology that you are most excited about, something that maybe a lot of people aren't aware of?
We do need baseline storage for electricity, and therefore I think battery technology is key, and key to having even more efficient electric vehicles. That's where I see us going. And that way, transportation fuel, oil, we can get away from it almost entirely, except as a feedstock for industry.
Jerry Schnorr, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thanks, Charity.
Jerry Schnorr, he is a professor of civil and environmental engineering and co-director of the Center for Global and Regional Environmental Research at the University of Iowa. He'll be speaking about climate change and Iowa on Thursday, February 6th at Blank Park Zoo in Des Moines as part of their Hope for the Wild Conservation Speaker Series. Coming up in just a moment, a new novel takes us into Lagos, Nigeria, and shows us the vulnerability of a family clinging to middle class. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.